Creative, dedicated, and passionate, Nobby Kleiman is a financial planning and internet marketing expert who has had over 2 decades of experience as a financial advisor and consultant. A relentless self-starter, Mr. Kleiman has spent the majority of his career as a self-employed businessman who shares his financial expertise with individuals and large corporations. Mr. Kleiman has been developing his own presentations and methods for 5 years after being wholly dissatisfied with what was available in the financial planning education market. Through his own research and development, he has created a system of teaching methods and a book series that provide no-nonsense, honest advice about planning properly for the future. In his past life as a financial advisor and consultant, Mr. Kleiman has been responsible for the annual management of more than $25 million in client funds and has facilitated the implementation of millions of dollars of insurance for many of Australia's big brand name companies and organisations. At the age of 54, Nobby retired as a financial planner, completely debt-free and financially independent. Mr. Kleiman serves an example to others of the goals they can achieve and the freedom they will have when with a debt-free future and lifestyle. Mr. Kleiman continues to work by consistently spreading his knowledge of how to achieve the dream of being debt-free. In addition to these attributes, for the past 6 years, Mr. Kleiman has rigorously embraced internet marketing and social media so he can reach a wider range of clients and help them with their financial situations. Proving that his success as a financial planner was no accident, Nobby has become successfully connected with well-known figures in internet marketing through strategic marketing practices. And today we're actually going to be talking about one of Nobby's secret weapons for the success of his own financial planning practice. Welcome, Nobby.
G'day, Zach. How are you going?
Very well. Thanks for joining me on the call.
Really good to be here, Zach. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. So I've just brushed over your sort of time as your past life, so to speak, as a financial planner. Could you sort of just tell us a bit more about yourself and your financial planning practice?
Sure. Look, I joined the financial planning industry when it was actually the insurance industry, so to speak, back in 1987. And I started on a Monday, and on Friday the share market crashed. Introduction to financial planning. And of course, then whenever I went out to speak to people, it was like, no, I don't want to invest in shares because they were all frightened of shares, little knowing that that was the best time to be getting in.
Yep.
But what it did allow me to do was, I suppose, concentrate far more on the risk side of financial planning, where you look after the insurance and income protection and disablement insurance for clients. But what I really enjoyed was when compulsory superannuation came about, and I was able to sink my teeth into that. I went back to all the clients that I used to deal with in a previous occupation, and because they'd felt comfortable with me, allowed me to set up their company superannuation funds for their staff, and we got them all underway like that. That also included topping up their life insurance or including their life insurance within the superannuation fund. So I really enjoyed that time of my life, and it was good, hard, honest work, and we're out there helping a lot of people and also earning an income from it. So that was great stuff. I really enjoyed that. Of course, as you went along, more and more rules came into the industry, and it evolved from being the insurance agent to becoming more qualified. Everybody wanted to be on the same level and be accepted as professionals, just like doctors and lawyers and accountants. So education was something that started being pushed, and that was something that I took on very early in the piece anyway. There was a industry called the Australian Financial Advisor, not sure now, but I took all of their courses early in the years. That took me about 3 or 4 years to get through. And then when the industry started pushing education and reform to be looking far more professional, started doing each of those as well. And took a while to get through those to the point where it then became, it was no longer something that you decided you wanted to do. It became compulsory and it had to be completed. You had to get to a certain level. So everybody was pushed to complete that, and then, of course, somebody decided, well, there's more education, and it was widely recognised that the more education was just another way of making more money, and in essence, nothing really has changed, in my opinion, than it just being a money-making exercise. But I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much education you've got. It's what you went out and did for the clients. And it's the experiences that I had with clients and other advisors that I knew. When you went out to a client's place and you saw them while they were sick, they were dying, after they died and you took a check out to their place, that's what really drove home the value of the work that I was doing. And I felt blessed to be in an industry that could help people in their greatest times of need. So, but what was it about 2005, things started really changing in the industry to the point that became ludicrous as far as I was concerned. Compliance, auditing, government intervention, and all the rules and regulations that they just started pushing. And while change is a good thing and should be taken advantage of, it was just becoming ridiculous and harder every day to go about talking to your clients because you are so bogged down in doing paperwork. They say that you should spend 80% of your time or 90% of your time talking to clients and the rest of the time just doing paperwork. But the way the industry was going with all this new regulation and everything, it was the other way around. And I found that it was no longer fun for me. So I decided that enough was enough, and I put my practice up for sale and sold it in 2006 in February, did a really good deal, and moved out, I think it was, in about the end of April. Took a couple of years off and found that I'd got bored and decided I want to get back into helping people with managing money, and that was how I got into doing all my stuff with Money Rules.
Okay.
So there you go. I've probably kept going for a bit long. But that's all right.
It's important to understand, you know, what, you know, where you're coming from. So I suppose because we're both marketers by background, and was really newsletter marketing assistance is about, you know, helping you maintain customers for life. I suppose we probably should start by talking about, you know, you went out, like, probably doing a lot of the sort of standard financial planning methods for customer acquisition, but from what I sort of understand, talking to you in preparation for this interview, you also had a sort of a fairly unconventional approach to keeping your customers. Would you be willing to share a bit more about sort of the marketing side of your practice?
Yeah, look, I suppose what I really enjoyed doing, as I said, I picked up a lot of my clients from previous industry which I was in, which was actually selling automotive spare parts. So I started dealing with a lot of larger companies. And rather than going out and knocking on doors like a lot of the guys had told me I should be doing and sitting down with a telephone book and making phone calls all day, when I actually went to these employers, I had a ready-made client database within their employees. So what I did was start offering them all the different services that we had. And I would prepare a sheet for them and say, well, look, apart from doing superannuation, these are the other things that we can do. And back then it was also general insurance. We had a general insurance brokerage in our division. So we said, look, you know, if you need car insurance or house and contents insurance or anything like that, give us a call and we'll be happy to help you. So it wasn't just offering one thing. A lot of guys, of course, you know, a lot of people were in there, and it was the old hit and run, make a quick sale, grab the commission and try and find the next person. Whereas I believed that working on a relationship and building that relationship, including trust, needed to be done on a regular basis. So it wasn't just a hit and run and move on. It was going back on a regular basis and seeing these people. The problem with that was, of course, time, because it didn't matter how often you went back, you weren't always going to make money, but you still wanted to be in front of all of these people. So I had to keep looking for different ways to get in front of them. And on my own, I started sending out just an update letter of once a quarter to say, look, this is things that are going on, and by the way, here's a new product that's available or a new service that's available or something like that. But it was a very expensive way to do it all on my own. And eventually we evolved into doing it as a group in the division. We had about 60 people in the division, and we all got together, and there was a core group of us who decided, yep, marketing was an important thing to do for client acquisition. So there were a number of different ways that we could have done it. Telemarketing or telesales was one way to go because that was very popular at the time, but also very expensive.
Yeah.
And I never liked that. I think a lot of people who were sitting at home getting phone calls in the evening while they're having their dinner, being asked if they wanted an appointment with an insurance advisor, was not one of their preferred phone calls to get at the time of the night.
I don't think anyone likes that phone call, but people persist with it.
That's right, they do. And look, it works for some people, but not for everybody. So I prefer the far more personal approach. For me, it's a more softly. I'd rather land in their letterbox and allow them the opportunity to say, okay, here's a letter. It's from Nobby. I'll open that because I know that he's generally got something good to say. He may have a bit of information in there that could be of value to me. It'll take me, you know, a couple of minutes to scan it. If there's nothing there, it'll end up with everything else on the coffee table and eventually end up in the round filing bin.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing with direct mail. A lot of it does end up in the bin, but at the same time, it's still very effective for the way to generate a customer cost at a very low cost if you do it properly. And the key is with direct mail, I think, is always to do it properly because most people get that part wrong.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Sorry, what were you saying, sir?
I was just going to say, Zach, that you know the most important part was they could see that the envelope was from me before they even got to open it.
Yeah,
and I know there was many times where I actually followed up with clients later on with visits to their house, and the newsletter was still actually sitting on their coffee table. I'd say, I see you got the newsletter, and they said, yep, I read through it. That's why you're here.
Terrific. And, yeah.
Look, for what it cost, can I tell you the newsletter was a very, very, very effective way to get to clients because it was cheaper than making a phone call.
Yep.
In the long term, I mean, obviously there's a cost in your printing and the time it puts together and postage and that sort of thing. But and a phone call should never be avoided. A phone call is the best thing you can do. However, when you're going out to do a bulk contact, newsletters are, in my opinion, one of the fastest and quickest methods to be out there in front of as many people as you can possibly be and be cost-effective at the same time.
Yeah.
You can't sit on the phone and call all those clients at the same time.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, sort of how many clients did you have in your practice when you started your newsletter?
Oh, look, when I started, I had nothing.
Yeah. Once you were up and running.
Yeah, once I was up and running, I probably had around 2,500 to 3,000 clients.
You can't make that many phone calls in a month.
No, you can't. That's quite true. And by the same token, I would also go on to say that although they may have all been technically clients, they were more policyholders. Anybody who ran a successful business knew that only 20% of any of their client base are the ones that actually generate their income.
Yep.
So you've got to be in front of that 20% on a far more regular basis than you are in front of the whole 100%.
Yeah.
So not everybody got a newsletter all the time. The schedule on which I ran my contacts to clients were every quarter, every client got a newsletter, irrespective of whether they're an A, B, C, or D.
Yep.
Everybody got a newsletter. And while many people said, look, you're just wasting your money writing out to your C's and D's,
yep.
C's and D's have the opportunity to climb the ladder. You never know what changes in their life and, moves them up to that next notch.
Well, I mean, just out of interest, roughly, what would you say a nominal value of a sort of a C or a D client is to you? I mean, are we talking a couple hundred bucks a year, $500 a year, much?
Yeah, look, C's were probably, from memory, anywhere between $500 to $1,000 a year. And D's were anybody who was less than that and obviously just had a policy which may have been paid up and wasn't really providing you with any income whatsoever.
So just
didn't really warrant a contact as such under normal circumstances.
Yeah. But if they called you, you'd certainly talk to them type thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And just getting back to the point, I mean, you're sending out your newsletter. I mean, for every year that they stay with you, it's an extra at least $500 in your pocket. It's certainly money well spent, compared to the onerous task of getting on the phone or to stay in touch with them. The newsletter's a much more cost effective way to at least improve the chances of them renewing their policy in the next year, yes?
Look, I would say that if you were able to convert 10% of your C clients, you would more than pay for the newsletter or marketing costs for the whole database.
Yeah.
So it totally covered. No problem.
Yeah, definitely. So just going to probably delve a bit more into the into the results your newsletter got for your practice. Did you, like, compared to industry averages, did you see that your clients were more loyal because of your marketing system to build a relationship and your use of newsletters? Did you see a marked difference in the loyalty of your clients or how much they were willing to spend with you?
Absolutely. And that is unequivocal. Whenever I went out to talk to new clients, I can very easily say that 90% of my new business came from referrals.
Okay.
And the only way you're going to get that sort of a strike rate is if you've been loyal and looking after your existing clients.
Absolutely.
They want to know that you're there for the long term.
Yeah.
The newsletter was in front of them all the time, so you're always top of mind awareness.
Yeah.
Your name would immediately come to their tongue if it was like my insurance guy. And, of course, how often was it that there were Choice magazine sneaky investigations going on where they're saying, insurance advisors and financial planners and all of this were blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And many people would stand up and say, do you know what, that's probably true, but my guy is not like that. My guy is pretty good. He's in touch with me all the time. He does this and everything else.
Yeah.
And I know that many clients complained after I got out of the industry because they stayed in touch.
Yeah.
And they said, since you've left, we haven't heard anything from the new guy. And that's like 2 years later.
Yeah.
Which is good.
There's probably not a whole lot of movement with financial planners' clients most of the time. Compared to the industry average, your clients were sort of staying longer, like twice as long, three times as long, or did you ever really have a client defection problem?
I never had a client defection problem. I had, I think in all the time that I was there, I had about two, maybe three clients who actually left me to go somewhere else. And quite often what you would find in the industry was my mates just joined the industry or my friends joined the industry and they're going to look after my policies. And you would soon find them coming back because it was damned hard to be in it.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, well, they've gone. Can you look after it again for me, please?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you spend all this time getting a client, you'd want to be damn sure you're going to keep them.
Yeah.
What was that?
You do spend a lot of time. When you think about it, you do spend a lot of time getting a client, setting the client up in your database, opening your files. Well, in the old days, you used to open files, putting them into your filing cabinet, making sure that you followed them up, followed up all of their paperwork. Because none of that was easy. One guy did have somebody in his office. He'd walk in, he'd drop the file on the desk, and he'd walk off and do another one. In fact, this particular guy, very well known in the industry at the time, would he'd hop on a truck out at Broadmeadows and and do the paperwork in the cab with him up to Albury, and then he'd catch a truck back from Albury and write another income protection policies because he was damn good at what he did.
Oh, that's classic. That's awesome.
He used to be a butcher out at Deer Park, which was really funny, but he became one of the top income protection writers for National Mutual at the time.
Yeah.
So that was real commitment. You know, he put a lot of time and effort into it. Same thing, but he was one of the classic guys that was hit and run. He'd be talking to one individual truckie at a time.
Yeah.
He didn't care to look after the rest of their stuff. He was focused on writing one type of policy. Which obviously, you know, was of no real benefit if something else happened to those guys. How much business did he let go?
Yeah.
And not look at
that as well. I'll push you on that at the moment.
No, that's fine. But, you know, again, he wasn't in touch with those people either. Yeah. He wrote the policy and that was the last time he saw them. So never in touch with them again.
Yeah. So just, I'm going to circle back around to the your comment that 90% of your business came from referrals.
Yes.
Now, sort of, I know that most people think referral, most, just about any business, you know, business, people think referrals happen by accident. Is that the same for financial planners?
No. There's nothing accidental about getting a referral.
Except, yeah. I've started to look at referrals basically as a lead source the same way that SEO traffic is a way to get new customers or that. And it has to be approached just as systematically. It's just the tools you use are different. So do you want to, could you sort of tell us a bit about how, how you generated, you know, referrals on the back of your newsletter? Or just referrals in general?
The synergy between SEO strategies and referrals is a very good one. It's what you do on the face of things that makes sure that your work ends up coming out the way that you want it to. You and I both know SEO strategies get people to your page, and in the same way, newsletters or marketing strategies or whatever it is that you do keep you top of mind awareness to your clients. And when those clients are speaking to other people at barbecues or having a drink or a party or something, and eventually they'll talk about money, they'll talk about investments, they'll talk about how much do you make, do you have insurance of this or that nature, or where do you put your super or whatever is topical at the time. And they said, you know what, my guy is really switched on. I hear from him all the time and he keeps me up to date and informed. Now, it may very well be that you might not have actually spoken about the returns or anything like that in your super or that type of thing. But just the fact that you're constantly there, you are their insurance guy, and you therefore are more than happy to they're more than happy to refer you on to somebody else because they're comfortable with doing it.
Yeah.
You refer somebody you weren't comfortable with.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, we spoke about this before. There are people around that you just could not comfortably refer.
Yeah.
Yet, because of the different things that I did, one of my largest superannuation funds was Holden Special Vehicles.
Yep.
And I did things differently, which a lot of people didn't like me for, but they thought it was unique at the time and thought I was crazy. But come Easter time, I would go to Brumbies and I would say to Brumbies, look, I've got 250 people. I need hot cross buns, and they're all to be put into cellophane bags, and my card is to be attached.
Yep.
Put them in the back of my car, drive down to HSV, and I would walk throughout the factory with this tray of hot cross buns, handing them out. And
jeez, it's an easy way to be memorable.
Well, it is.
That's a fantastic Easter idea, right?
Well, it is. I mean, it's topical at the time, and it's totally, totally different. It's out of left field, and people don't forget. Some people would say, no, mate, I don't want to buy any. And I'd say, no, it's not for sale. Just take one. And it would be, well, my mate's not here at the moment, but he'll be back shortly. Take one for your mate as well. So it was like when they knew that there was no sales pitch involved, the barriers came down, and this is how they all got to know me. Other times I would walk through the place, I'd go into Safeways or Coles or whatever, and I'd buy the bags of Cherry Ripes with the small 12-pack in them or 20-pack. Yep. And they were like $3 or something like that. And I would stuff my pockets with these little Cherry Ripes. And as I walked throughout the offices of HSV or through the workshops in HSV and all other clients as well, even my accountant is upset if I come up there without Cherry Ripes. And I would just hand out Cherry Ripes. Now, all these, even the guard on the gate got Cherry Ripe. These guys all got to know me, and I'd walk through and they'd say, "You're the super guy."
Yep.
And I'd say, "Yeah." So I need to talk to you about doing this rollover. I need to, you know, the barriers were down. They got to know who I was because I was different.
Yeah, and that's probably very important because trust is probably, it's very critical to what you do.
Yeah.
And it's, and let's face it, I mean, the man on the street doesn't, is coming to you because they don't know how to manage their own super. And they aren't going to know if you're any good until well after, that, you know, well after the sale's made, so to speak. So they have, they're sort of, you know, reverting to trust. So you've got to, you know, you need the trust first before they're ever going to talk to you about business.
Absolutely. And you and I both know that there's a saying that's going around that's like, you know, people will work with those whom they like, know and trust.
Yeah.
And you've got to build that before you can ask for the business.
Yeah, absolutely.
People need to know that you're going to be consistent.
Yep.
And you are going to be there and that you're going to be available because one of the last things they want to know is that you've come along, you've signed them up, and they're never able to talk to you again. They bought on the basis of they were dealing with you, but now all they get is pushed off to someone else because you don't care enough to talk to them anymore about their money. So that's another thing that, you know, another issue people need to be careful about. Is managing expectations.
Yeah. So can we sort of go back to this trucky insurance writer of yours about how he's only selling one product line?
Yeah.
Did you use your newsletter at all to promote the other product lines that you were that you offered? So you sold multiple types of insurance. You sold you had sort of wealth creation, superannuation type products as well. Did you sort of cyclically promote those in your newsletters?
Yeah, absolutely. What we had was the newsletter was basically A3 is double of the A4, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. So we would take advantage of that to cover multiple issues, and yet what we tried to do was interweave them and show how one was connected to another. We'd try and show examples of how and insurance was of benefit to a particular client. So we're using real-life circumstances, you know.
Kind of like case study type.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's nothing, you know, people associate immediately with the old story of I know how you feel, I felt that way, or many people have felt that way, and this is how you can feel.
Yes.
So now it's a matter of getting them to understand that there's a matter of urgency with it. And you do that with your newsletter in saying, look, one of the problems is as you get older, the premiums increase. If you look at it now before your birthday, it's a perfect time.
Yep.
In fact, the number of contacts I had with clients, as I said earlier, everybody got a newsletter at least once a quarter.
Yep.
Other clients who were higher up the scales, the A's and B's, were getting policy renewal reminders on the anniversary date. So a month before the renewal, I'd send out another letter.
Yep.
For their birthday, they'd get something. For Christmas, they'd get a card. All those sorts of things. But the main one for everybody was always the newsletter.
Yep.
And we were able to put so much information into the newsletter as compared to the single letter that was going out for a solitary reason, such as a policy anniversary or a birthday. So the newsletter was good from that point of view of covering all the different aspects, even though we might be going over the same thing, such as investments for superannuation. We could introduce a different way or a different offering, talking about the difference between, you know, guaranteed investments and non-guaranteed and all those sorts of things.
I suppose a big thing for you is that, you know, different things are happening in your clients' lives at different time. So just because they said no, my super's fine as it is 6 months ago, doesn't mean they're not worried about it now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the media obviously played a big part in that. Yeah. You look at what the GFC did for the world. There was nobody that knew nothing about the GFC. They knew the world was in deep hole. And of course, the moment that people started getting their annual superannuation statements, it was brought home very starkly to them. Well, guess who should have been in touch with them at that time? Before they even got their statements, it should be, you should be prepared for a pretty bad scenario. Now, you could send that out in the newsletter to everybody, but you could make it, what's the word? You could make it of value. You could say, do you know what? Here's a scenario. The world's in deep poo at the moment. Things are black. They're going to get better eventually. And what you've got to look at is it's there for the long term. So you've broken down that initial barrier of fear. Whereas if you say nothing, and this is what frightened a lot of people and one of the reasons why companies like Choice were so successful with their frightening marketing against financial planners and that, was because many financial planners stuck their head in the sand and decided not to do anything. They didn't want to pick up the phone and tell clients how bad their super returns were going to be. Who wants to do stuff like that? But the reality is even financial planners' superannuation was affected. Yeah. So here it is. You send it out in the newsletter and you say, do you know what? We're all in for a big shock. My superannuation fund is in the same investment as yours. I've done nothing. I've recommended nothing different to you than I would have done for myself. So we're all in for a bit of a shock when the fund reports come out. Here are the steps I'm taking and that you should be considering as well. Easily done.
No, definitely. So next question. Did you do sort of any sort of make offers to your existing clients outside of your newsletter at all?
Yes, we did.
And did you find that response generally went up on the back of you doing all the relationship building exercises, including sending the newsletter?
Yeah, the offers that we made outside of the newsletter were basically like annual get-togethers. At my office, we might turn around and have a annual end-of-year or mid-year barbecue.
Yep.
So we'd invite clients around for that.
Yep.
Was
that also an opportunity for them to bring in potential new clients or referrals for you?
Oh, look, you always said, you know, bring your family. You're more than welcome to bring the family because, of course, by then we'd already known so many of them. You didn't get a big turnout, but what you did get was an opportunity to spend good quality non-sales time with those people because you were just talking about stuff in general. They'd come down and they said, geez, your office looks great or, you know, love what you've done with this and that and everything and how's the footy and the cricket or whatever it is. Eventually they'd get around to saying, oh, you know, need to talk to you about blah, 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 or I've got a friend, I've told him about you. Here's his card or whatever, you know, get in touch with him. They're seeing you on a whole personable basis rather than being there in your suit and tie.
Yeah.
So you, once again, you're removing those barriers to doing business.
Terrific. Okay. Next question, I suppose. Did you ever sort of promote other sort of outside businesses to your existing customers? Did you refer them to, say, mortgage brokers or you know, other related businesses that, you know, they may. Did you ever sort of actively, you know, in internet marketing parlance, conduct joint ventures?
Can I tell you how hard that was to do?
I can only imagine.
It's like pulling hen's teeth, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to get people to understand what a joint venture is in saying, you know what, we're already going to mail out to X number of clients. How would you like to be involved? Now, many years ago, not far from me, and I knew this guy well, was Tony White-Nissen.
Yep.
You know, he got on TV dressed up the same as what Robert Palmer did with his big pencil and everything and all the good-looking girls.
Yep.
I went to Tony and I said, Tony, you know what, combined amongst the 20-odd advisors in our office who all get together and send out this newsletter, we're sending out letters to around, you know, 10,000, 12,000 people. How would you like to sponsor that for a year and all it's going to cost you to do is pay the postage. And he jumped on board that. He was brilliant. He could see that. So yep. he was really switched on. So we got all our mailings done for 12 months for nothing, which was fantastic.
Yep.
But when we approach people like mortgage brokers and accountants and solicitors, they were far more reticent. And it was, they're our client base. You know, we, or, you know, why would you let us do anything with your client base? We wouldn't share our client base with you. And that's what they were frightened of, was the reciprocity.
Yeah.
It was like, if you share with us, are you going to expect us to share our clients with you? And it was like, well, no, but that would be nice if you did. But so there was this underlying fear of sharing. And, you know, it's more about what's in it for them rather than what's in it for their clients.
Okay. Just, we'll go back to Tony White for a second. Did he, I'm hoping he did very well out of that deal and sold a lot of cars to your clients?
You know, the number of times that, because he was popular on TV at the time, people would say, oh, gee, you got Tony White doing this. Well, yeah, I know Tony. I know I bought my car from him.
Yeah.
And there were three, maybe four cars that were sold. But what it did was it put his name out there, whether he sold cars or not. Yeah. The cost of the actual postage was nothing because, of course, it was tax deductible.
Yeah.
But it was targeted marketing too, because the rest of his advertising, of course, was shotgun when it was done in newspapers and television and more expensive.
Yeah, true.
So here he was going directly to consumers of financial planners.
Yeah.
And those clients were already in that frame of mind where they were working with financial planners, whereas many people didn't. So you're already that little bit more advanced educationally in dealing with somebody and asking for some help than you know, trying to get through it yourself, or not even having the need and therefore not financially not being a financial necessity.
Okay. And finally, just going to move along, because I know we're sort of getting pressed for time here. The last thing we probably need to talk about is when you finally decided that you'd had enough of all the BS that had crept into the industry and decided it was time to sell your business.
Yep.
So did were you able to sell your practice at a premium compared to other practices of a comparable size?
Yes, I was. In fact, my practice had done quite well. I'd worked very hard from the time that I started, and I suppose leading up to the sale is a step in between where in 1994, AXA said, we're no longer providing subsidised rents to the offices, so you guys need to go out and find your own.
Yep.
And so we did, and eventually I ended up moving into an office of my own. And I approached a colleague who I knew was going to be retiring. And long story short, rather than him putting it out there on the market for everybody, which he did, he came back to me and said, okay, Nobby, I'm going to sell it to you. I've decided I'm going to sell it to you. And I said, thank you. And I said, but I haven't got the money. And he said, so how are you going to pay for it? And I said, well, tell you what, how about if over the next 5 years I pay you 50% of every commission that comes in, and that way you get what you want, which is 2.5 times, which is the normal going rate at that time for registers. So he said, yep, okay. He was happy enough with that. He trusted me with his business to just hand it over to me.
Yep.
It did drop by about 10% in the first year, and he had to change his underpants. But at the end of the 5 year period, he asked if we wouldn't mind extending it for an extra year, because by the end of 5 years, he actually ended up with 3.5 times of what it was worth. So he was quite happy. So when it came time for me to sell, everybody was of the opinion that what you needed to do was have a transition period of about 12 months to carry through. And I said, you know what, when I sell a house and move to the next one, I'm not going to stay living in the house while you become accustomed to it. So when I sell my practice, my register, you buy it and it's yours. I will help you for a little while by introducing you to the major clients, which I did for about 3 months. And then I moved on. But the sale was over and done with, and we took 50% up front and the other 50% at the end of the 3 months.
Yep.
So that was pretty good. Yep. I did make a mistake in the first 50%, but...
lessons learned if you ever start over.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a major mistake, and I live with it. But, yeah, look, and that was it. I just wanted to be out. The fun was gone, and it's like you don't want to be there and just drag on, continue the pain.
So, so if I understand this correctly, you got out 9 months sooner than you would under a typical sale of a practice or a register.
Yes, absolutely.
And you actually got a higher paid a premium price for the privilege of taking it over faster.
Yes, he did.
that's not all bad, is it?
It's not. And look, it's at the end of the day, the practice was a very, very good practice, both between myself and the guy whose register I'd taken over, which therefore doubled the size of my business.
Yeah.
We were both into predominantly writing risk business and corporate superannuation.
Yep.
So the business still left itself widely open to what was called financial planning.
Yep.
And I didn't particularly like financial planning.
Okay.
In the sense of what it truly is. And yet everything that was done was in the realm of financial planning.
Yeah.
So overall, the new guy had a big opportunity to go and write business.
In the existing client base. So there was,
there was
a massive amount of money on the table.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what we're talking about. You know, you leave enough money on the table for the next person.
Yeah, and this goes back to the your mate that was only selling income protection to truckers.
Yeah.
Same principle, I suppose. There was
absolutely
you're taking care of what you took care of.
Yeah.
And there was other opportunities there for someone else to come in.
Very much so.
Terrific. So just in summing up, because you put such a big emphasis on retaining your customers for life, rather than being a hit and run financial planner, I think you called them.
Yes.
So you were able to increase customer loyalty to the point where 2 years after you'd sold your practice, you still have people calling you to complain about the new guy.
Yes.
You got up to the point where 90% of your new business actually came via referral.
Yep.
Your customers were loyal for longer than industry average.
Yes.
You were able to sell those customers multiple product lines rather than just a single product, single line of business like your hit and run truck driving income protection guy.
Yep. Correct.
You're able to cross promote other businesses to it. For profit for yourself and for them, and ultimately sold your business faster and for a higher value than the industry average.
Absolutely.
Would you put most of that down to, writing your monthly customer newsletter and sending it to your clients?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a whole range of reasons why. I think personality obviously has a lot to do with it as well, because you do need to be liked by your clients.
Yep.
But I think contact, ongoing contact, regular contact with clients is of the utmost importance. They need to know you're there, that you're contactable, and that they can speak to you.
Thank you, Nobby. That's brilliant. Just before we pull it to an end, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Nothing much has changed. I'm still working at helping clients. So much so that, as I said earlier, that 2 years after I'd stopped working, the light switch came on and said, you're bored, go out and do something. So I developed the Money Rules suite of programs that actually show people now how to manage their daily money, because the biggest question I was always asked was, how do I do that? How do I manage my daily money? I know everything you do, Nobby. I know you do insurance. I don't need insurance advice or superannuation or investment or anything like that. I need to know, how do I manage my daily money? And I would say very simply, here it is, cheap advice, spend less than you earn and pay the highest interest debt first. Any good financial planner or accountant will tell you that. But, of course, people don't consider that to be as easy as that. So I actually then ended up developing a couple of programs. One is called Debt Easy, which is a people can get for free, and that's DebtEZEE. They can get that for free. And
what's the URL to go to for more information?
For that particular one, it is www.debtezee.com.au. And the main program is the Money Rules program, and it's far more involved than the Debt Easy program, which is very basic. But Money Rules is www.moneyrules.com.au,
yep.
And that will actually lead them off to the different sites.
Yep. Are there any freebies on either of those sites that you can claim just by just for signing up?
Yeah, look, the Money Rules site actually has an ebook, and from memory, so does Debt Easy. Debt Easy has something there. I mean, Debt Easy itself is free, so you can't do much better than that.
Okay.
And both come with videos. I love doing video. And one of the things that I'm looking to do is actually talk to people about not just eliminating their debt, but talk to them about debt elimination acceleration. Looking at other ways that they can actually earn money or make money without perhaps even getting a second job, just stuff they can do around the house or putting their experience to work for them. So,
perfect, yeah.
Yeah, so lots of things like that. And of course, I've just put out a book, and the book is predominantly for women. Women are going to love this. It's a pink cover.
Yep.
$2 from every book goes to breast cancer. And it's called Want More Money, Honey.
Okay. And what's the book about?
The book is about, what have we got? It's a practical guide to creating your financial security and stability. And, of course, one of the problems in today's society is so many women do end up on their own after relationship breakdowns. And they're left with the children, and they're still left with the debts and everything else to cope with. But
so they take on the bulk of the financial burden in relationships.
Yeah. Do you know, women are amazing because they just continue to survive. The guys, we're probably a lot weaker. We look to go home to mum and dad or the mates or something like that. But the women do, they do continue to survive, and I take my hat off to them. It's fantastic. And the problem, of course, is they can't always, when they're in that situation, afford to go and talk to a financial planner, because a financial planner can't work for nothing.
Mm.
That, you know, we need to recognise that. Same thing with an accountant. But I thought, you know what, for $30 they can buy the book, have a look through the book, and hopefully there's information in there that will help them get underway.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Nobby. That's been very insightful. And I'd urge you to go to DebtEasy, DebtEasy.com.au.
Yep.
And Money Rules, MoneyRules.com.au.
Yep.
And check out the resources there. And the book, The More Money Honey?
Want More Money Honey? You can actually go to www.wantmoremoneyhoney.com.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you very much, Nobby.
Thank you, Zach. It's been great.
Catch you later.
Bye.